what to do with plaintiff's fault, plaintiff's lack of reasonable care for themselves. What we're looking at this week, until we're rudely interrupted by Thanksgiving, is assumption of the risk, okay? The first thing I want to do is actually do some background using clickers. So this is, could you even read the basic rule, okay? Are you ready? So, we're doing true or false. So the first statement is, assumption of the risk occurs when plaintiff has agreed to relinquish her right to sue the defendant for wrongfully injuring her, or has unknowingly but voluntarily taken on the risk that she might be injured by defendant's negligence. True or false? So is that a correct overview of assumption of the risk? True or false? Do I get to take the cookies back? Yes, I'm pathetic.
That took me a couple classes to do it. I didn't know there was a power button on the bottom. Oh. So sometimes it wouldn't work, so I just thought that it didn't get to participate. That was back when we were getting cookies.
We get into a 25. Come on, I have to have at least 25. There's 34 of you in this room, so 24 is pathetic. That means 10 people don't know enough to click, which is sad.
We're missing this whole
room. Well, why not? Okay. It really works with a judge, Your Honor. I have a different case. Contempt. Okay, so it is false. Why is it false? Anyone who can read, why is it false? Yep. It's knowingly. Knowingly. Not unknowingly. Knowingly. Okay, we're back to reading. Correct answer. Okay, that's going to be, there it is, 21%. Okay, so notice that there's two definitions in there of assumption of the risk. Which one is known by the phrase express assumption of the risk? So if you look at that definition, it's got an or in it. So yeah, so which one is express? Right, so the plaintiff has agreed to relinquish their right to sue. We call this express assumption of the risk. In other words, it's an express waiver of your right to sue. Which means that the second concept, corrected to read knowingly but voluntarily taking on a risk that she might be injured by defendant's negligence, is called what? Implied assumption of the risk. By far the harder concept that we'll look at next class and Monday, okay? So there are two flavors, very distinct types of assumption of the risk. Okay, question number two, hopefully coming in at more than 21 pathetic percent. Assumption of the risk operates as a complete bar of plaintiff's claim. True or false? So far we're testing whether you could read the introductory paragraph on page 436. 1921. Oh, 25, one person woke up. Okay, guys. Sat like not good. Okay, so what's the answer? It is a complete bar. Okay, so it's true. So notice I'm going to take the cookies back. I'm gonna highlight something that's gonna cause you some problems reading tomorrow and next week when we get to looking at implied assumption limits. So assumption of the risk is a complete bar, plaintiff takes nothing. If you look back at comparative fault, okay, there was the old contrib system, and now almost all states have moved to comparative. complete barn. Old contrip. So back in the old days, you know, those awesome days when the British ruled the world, it didn't matter whether we called what plaintiff did contributory fault or assumption the risk, because the result was always plaintiff takes nothing, right? So it didn't really matter whether we characterized plaintiff's behavior as plaintiff's fault or assumption the risk, because the result was the same. Anyone notice the problem today once we change the comparative fault? Yep, Mr. King?
Well, one way it would be bar, and the other way it wouldn't necessarily be. So you have to be careful what you,
bingo,
what you call it.
Excellent, right? Today, with comparative fault, in most systems, plaintiff's recovery is simply discounted unless plaintiff's over 50%. So today, it very much matters whether we characterize something as assumption of the risk or whether we characterize it as this defense of comparative fault. See that? So see how today is really important? Yep.
Could you argue both?
That's what it gets so nasty tomorrow. Exactly. The sum behavior of the plaintiff that looks like both. And the question is, what do we do with it now? Okay? So I'm sort of highlighting the problem you're reading for tomorrow. The problem you're reading for tomorrow and implied assumption there is when do we say what plaintiff did is this? When do we say it's this? Can we say it's both? Okay? Good. That'll make tomorrow's less painful, though apparently today's easy reading was painful. Stop beating up on them. Okay. Okay, number three. Assumption of the risk requires a showing that plaintiff was negligent as to her own safety. True or false? Assumption of the risk requires a showing that plaintiff was negligent as to her own safety. Uh-oh, two people died. Nope. 24. Is that what we're sticking with? 25. There it is. False at 19. Wow, you got over 24% for one of them. Excellent. Okay. So what defense is it that asks whether the plaintiff was negligent at her own safety? Answer?
Comparative.
Right? This plaintiff's fault concept is the concept that plaintiff lacked reasonable care for her own safety. That's the core of comparative fault. It's not the core of assumption of the risk. Okay? And then the last question. Assumption of the risk is not a defense to intentional tort or to claims of recklessness, aka willful or wanton conduct. So true or false, assumption of the risk does not operate as a defense to intentional torts or to recklessness. True or false? Stunning 64%. It is true. Okay, so assumption of the risk is simply a defense to negligence. And in fact, that's illustrated in the first case you read, because in Jones, there was a gross negligence claim and a negligence claim. And assumption of the risk only acts as a defense to negligence. Okay, what is the defense to intentional tort that's like this?
I don't know. That was the beginning of the semester.
Answer? Consent, right? So instead of saying express assumption of the risk and intentional tort actions, we say consent. Good. Okay, you happy? Or equally all unhappy? Okay. I want to focus in today on this first defense of express assumption of the risk. So that's what we're going to focus on today. Okay? Done big picture, we're honing in a little bit. Issue spotting. Okay? What facts would be present to cause you to address the issue of express assumption of the risk? Some kind of written agreement, written contract, right? Before the negligent act, so you're looking at some kind of written contract made in advance of the activity. Okay. Next big picture. What you should recognize is that assumption, the express assumption of the risk is actually a battle between me and distal horse. Right? Okay? It's me versus distal horse. So let's focus first on me, because I'm more important, at least in my own eyes. What did defendants allegedly do wrong in Jones and Delury? So how about Jones? What did the defendants allegedly do wrong? To summarize why there's a tort, what did they allegedly do wrong? They negligently flew the plane so it crashed. Okay? What did they allegedly do wrong in Delury? Right, they placed the poles in an improper place, causing risk to the plaintiff. So in both cases, they're negligently causing injury to others. Okay, what is defendant's basic argument in both cases that they shouldn't have to pay? There's an exculpatory agreement. Excellent. Both of them point to a waiver or exculpatory agreement as the reason they shouldn't have to pay. So what are they actually arguing? Who wins? Gillis, distal horse. What's their argument?
Distal horse.
Their argument is distal horse wins, right? Contract trumps torts. We were negligent, but contract trumps it. Everybody see? So this is a battle between tort law and contract law. Contract law is trying to trump their tort liability. Everybody see the conflict? Okay. So what questions do you need to answer to work out whether contract or torts is going to win? Right? So, and it'll work out on the sheet. What questions do you need to answer to tell whether the court will enforce an express assumption of the risk? One. What do you think? So when you look at the opinions, what was one of the first questions they asked before they're going to go ahead and enforce it? Is there a valid contract? Excellent. And something else you need to know. And its terms what? That's not the first question, so hold that. Well, the first question is, do you have a valid contract and do its terms? Yeah, clearly or unambiguously cover this claim. So you've got to make sure you have a valid contract and that its terms clearly or unambiguously waive this claim. Okay. Who cares about that shit? I mean that subject matter. Arthur? Distal horse! Okay, so of course he has to present a valid contract. Okay, what's the second question, Mr. Cox?
Is it good for public policy?
Is it good for public policy, right? Does enforcement of the waiver of the express assumption of the risk violate public policy? So, who wins, contract or torts? Who has the ultimate power? Torts, right? Everybody see, the second question is a question by tort law. Will we accept this contract? It's a valid contract, expressly covers it, but we can still say, no, get your stupid contract out of here. We're still going to impose liability. So everybody see what issue we're going to focus on? Number two, which is, when is it tort law will refuse to enforce a valid contract? Okay, so let's take a quick look at Jones, okay? And the first thing I want to give you to tell me about, though we don't really care about it, is contract problems. Did you see some contract points? It's not a valid contract. Okay, anyone give me that it's not a valid contract?
He was 17 million
contracting. Nice old contract doctrine. Get it out of my class. Any other cute little contract issues that you saw? So any other contract issues that were raised right here?
Justin Jones.
Yes, we're doing Jones. And what do you use this phrase? It's an adhesion contract. It's not valid because it's an adhesion contract, right? That's contract talk, right? That the parties didn't fully negotiate it, so there was no real underlying consent, right? That's contract world, okay? And what does the court say to that? Was there a valid contract?
Yes.
Why? He could go elsewhere. Any other reasons? It wasn't a necessary service. That's why he could go somewhere else.
He had an option also if he wanted to give him liability, so he could bargain for that.
There you go. So it looks as if he has a bargaining option because he can sign on to this. It's okay if you're negligent. It's not okay to. So it looks as if it's not a contract of adhesion. Okay? And then the last thing we said, we got a valid contract. What's the next thing we have to check? Under number one, we got a valid contract, we have to check its
language.
We still have to check its terms, remember? Under number one, we have to make sure we have a valid contract. We have to check its terms. So, the terms of the contract are actually on 437. So what is it we're looking to see if they waived? What claim is it we're looking to see if they waived? What claim? What underlying tort claim are we looking to see if they waived? Negligently crashed the airplane. Okay? So, let's look at it. Is it a waiver of liability? Answer. Does it cover personal injury? Because it says loss or injury to the plaintiff. Okay, does it cover injury on the aircraft, not when like skydiving? I mean, that's what you think. Oh, the idiot jumping out of the plane. But this is actually a plane crash, so does it cover them negligently crashing the plane?
Yes.
Why, what does it say?
It says, while upon the premises or aircraft of the corporation.
While on the aircraft, so it looks as if it does waive this claim. How about, does it waive it even if the defendants were negligent? Oh, I don't think we need good wings. Let's just go with the, does it cover it even if the defendants negligently caused the crash? Yes, because? Resulting from the negligence. And if you're signing these suckers, that's what you want to look at, right? Because a waiver without the negligence isn't really problematic. Okay, you're agreeing. But the question is, are you waiving it when they're negligent? Some of them even say you waive it when they act intentionally, even though that one's not valid. Okay, so it looks as if the express terms waive this claim. Everybody agree? So now we get to the fascinatingly awesome tort bit, which is whether we're going to let this clause have effect or whether we're going to reject it as a matter of tort law. And the test we use, which hopefully you will have picked up on page 440, is the Tunkel factors, right? See that big block quote which you skimmed over without reading properly? Yes, there's an error. Okay, so if you look at the Tunkel factors, you can break them down into about four factors that we will look at to decide whether to give effect to the contract. So one, defendant's service is of great importance, often practical necessity to members of the public. Two, defendant offers its service to the public at large. Three, because it offers an essential service, we see a disparity in bargaining power. And then four, that awesome gobbledygook, which we'll work out in a minute, as a result of the transaction, the personal property of the plaintiff, the purchaser, is under control of the seller, subject to the risk of carelessness by the seller. So, I want to run these factors with different hypos. And the first hypo I want to run is actually the facts in Tunkel itself. which you have to work hard to find because they're in the next case. And the facts in Tunkel are that plaintiffs showed up in the emergency room of a hospital and they said, well, we will treat you if you sign this express waiver of any claim of negligence. Okay? And so the question was whether the court would enforce this express waiver signed by the plaintiff in order to get access to emergency medical services. So let's try and use the Tunkel factors. So the service, defendant's service, is of great public importance. What do you think?
Yes.
I heard no dissent. Okay, number two, defendant offers its service to the public. Number three, defendant, because it offers an essential service, is able to force adhesion contracts or no opt-out.
Yes.
What's the answer?
Yes.
Because?
It's an emergency room. He doesn't have the option of going somewhere else.
Right. Plaintiff is bleeding to death on the floor in the emergency room. He's going to sign anything, right? So notice, these factors are interesting to Professor Distelhorst because they show what?
Contractual capacity.
Right, valid contract, right? They're interesting to us because they show what? Why do we care about these factors? Because we don't really care about the contract. So we're using them for something else. What are we using them to show? It violates public policy. Why? What do these factors indicate? The fact that the defendant can get an adhesion contract without an opt-out tells what? No bargaining power if the contract works. We don't, what do they tell us? So why is the court interested in these two factors? What do they tell us about defendant's service? We already got public, so we're working on it.
It's necessary.
It's essential, right? This is so essential to the public that we're willing to sign away to get it. So notice, we're using these two factors to tell us that defendant service is not only of great public importance, open to the public, that's spelled open, open to the public, but we can tell it's an essential service because defendant can hold the public to ransom, right? Sign this, no opt-out, or you don't get it. That tells us how important a service it is. See, so we're using those factors to tell us it's an essential service. And I want, and how about the hospital? Is it an essential service? Yes. Hospital is over here. One, two, three. And I want to look at what four is. So you have to insert the word hospital for defendant, and for P, you got to insert patient.
Custodial care?
It's not custodial care. It's cute though. It's close. It's something that flows from custodial care. So what are we saying? You insert hospital for defendant and patient for purchaser.
There's a special relationship that exists between.
Nope, that's what he tried. It's cute. That's not what it's saying. It doesn't say special relationship, or I would use those words. Right? It's not that strong. What is it simply saying? Doesn't say relationship. It says someone can do what and someone can't do what. Control what? So who can control the risks, the likelihood of injury? And who can't? The patient. So we're looking for a scenario where the defendant controls the risks. Everybody see that's what it's asking for? Does defendant control the risks? Not the plaintiff. That's what that phrase is asking for. Okay, and how about for a hospital? Who controls the risks of negligent conduct or careless conduct? The hospital. So see, every single factor is met, So we're easy to say we won't enforce it. Right? Now, is the truncal you have to get all of them, or how does it describe this test? You have to get all of them, it's 1 and 2 and 3 and 4?
No, it's
1
of them is met, and it's 1 of
them. So you only have to get 1 of them? Yep.
There's something factors.
There's simply factors that we balance together to tell us whether or not we're willing to enforce this express waiver. Everybody see? So these factors are supposed to tell us whether, as a matter of public policy, tort law will enforce the waiver. Everybody good? Yep.
So does that mean you could have all four and they could still deem it not a public policy decision and rule against you?
It's possible. It seems unlikely, right? All four of them are there. But the problem it creates is how many do you need to get to make it unenforceable? Right? That's the more likely scenario you're litigating. Okay, so let's do Jones. And he was skydiving, right? Defendant's service is of great public importance. What do you think? Yes or no? Okay. Defendant's service is open to the public.
Yes.
Okay. Defendant's service is essential, and we can tell that by the fact that there was a contract of adhesion with no opt-out. No. And why is that? Why are we so clear that that's a no?
It was not
a take it or leave it because for, well, the key fact is
for.
For $50, you could avoid the exculpatory clause, right? So we're pretty clear that one's not met, okay? So how about the last one? Defendant controls the risk, not the plaintiff. Is that one met?
Yes.
Yes, right? Or anyone think not? You can argue this one.
Well, could you say going into the plane is taking control of the risk because you're voluntarily entering the plane?
We're asking the risk of negligence. So what we're asking is who really controls the risk of negligence? So in the hospital situation, it's all the nurses and the doctors who control the risk. So right here, we're asking who really controls the risk of carelessness. So do anyone want to say, we got a no, we got a yeah, yep?
He doesn't pull the chute, so he can probably control the risk.
So you want to say kind of half and half? Right, some of it is his, he has to control certain risks, but the defendant company has to control certain risks. Yep?
I would argue it's like a risk over situation where defendant, pilots, employees control it until you jump out of the plane and then you're kind of on your own for what happens from there.
Okay, so that was really interesting because you played with what it is we're saying the defendant's activity is. Notice how we have it up there. Defendant's activity is providing skydiving, right? Okay, and that's what we played with. And what does the court say? Is it enforceable or not? And Jones, enforceable or not?
Yes.
Yes, it is enforceable. They say when we look at those factors, we think two of them are not present, so we're going to go ahead and let the contract be enforceable. Did we see that? Anyone want to ask the question differently, which is what the plaintiff is trying to do? How does the plaintiff want us to characterize the service offered by the defendant? So how does the plaintiff want us to characterize the service offered by the defendant?
He says
they were providing an airplane service, right? They're a common carrier. So let's see if we buy into his idea that they're a common carrier operating a plane. Just like Delta or United or Southwest. That's what he wants, the plaintiff wants us to run. Is defendant service of great importance? Operating a plane? Yes. Is it open to the public? Was there an opt-out clause? Now there's still the problem with the opt-out clause. However, how essential does the service look? It's pretty good. So notice you get a 50-50 because we've changed it from it's skydiving essential to it's flying around essential. And how about who controls the risk of negligence? Just the defendant, right? So if you changed it to defendant is a common carrier, would you enforce the contract or not? You wouldn't, right? Because look how many Tunkel factors are net. So see, that's the argument the plaintiff is trying to make. The plaintiff says, hey, we should be talking about whether they were, it's a skydiving activity. We should be talking about whether they're an airplane, a common carrier, because when you run common carriers, we're going to conclude we won't enforce it. Yep?
Do you have to prove the common carrier first?
Or what's his problem?
Well, the court says it's not a common carrier.
Because they find this FAA regulation that defines an airline as what? So why do they say he can't get into this box? They say, nope. You can't get into this box. You're going in that box. That's why we say it's. So what rule?
It says whether the carriage by air is merely incidental to the person's other business or is in itself a major interest.
And what is it here?
The incidental.
Bingo. So the court says he can't get into this box because he's not really a common carrier. He's just flying incidental to providing skydiving services. So therefore, we should ask about skydiving as his activity, not being a airline. Yep.
So if we're not enforcing it, that's saying that we believe it's against public policy? Or?
Correct. Okay. So the more Tunkel factors you get, the more we're going to say, Distal Horse, your contract stinks, we won't enforce it. The fewer Tunkel factors you get, the more we say, oh, it's not too problematic, we'll enforce your contract. Correct. So the more Tunkel factors you ramp up, the more it's against public policy to enforce it. Yes?
I'm a little confused by number three. Are you supposed to be looking at whether the service itself is essential or whether there's an adhesion contract?
Well, what did we say the relationship between the two was?
That if you had bargaining power?
Then it demonstrates what?
It is an adhesion
contract. Uh-huh. Why are we using adhesion and opt-out? What did we say tort law once wrote? To show if it's essential. So the heart of number three is defendant service essential? And the court uses whether it was an adhesion contract, right, as a way to show, oh, it was so essential, right? So the focus of the inquiry is, was defendant service essential? And looking at adhesion and opt-out will help us understand how essential it was. It was so essential you couldn't walk away. You had to take it. See it? Yeah.
So what do you do in situations like the common carrier where there is no opt-out or adhesion, but it is an essential service?
So you're going, this is sort of a split fact. So this one, if there was really no opt-out, then every single factor is met. Right? That makes it even stronger. See that? Here, we have an opt-out, but we're kind of like, yeah, but it's an airline. So that's why we split it 50-50. Most of the time for common carrier, right, you do it. Like, okay, go ahead, get on COTA, bus. Services are great importance. Open to the public. Opt-out provision. I would like to renegotiate the contract as I board the bus. Not happening. So you meet this one. The service is essential. Last one. Defendant controls the risks. Yes, it's not you're going to cause the bus to crash. So common carriers slam right through this. We only had a little caveat right here if you treat Jones as a common carrier because he gets to negotiate that opt-out, which is atypical for common carriers. Okay, where are we going next? Oh. Let's do these public policy considerations typically lead courts to some generalized conclusions. So see the bottom of the sheet? And then tell me what generalized conclusions courts often pull from running the Tunkel factors. They're going to give effect to a contract if the activity is what? I heard it.
Recreation.
it's recreational. So if the activity is recreational, the court is likely to say it fails 1 and 3, right? It's not of great importance and it's not essential. So you can predict that recreational activities, the court is likely to give effect. It's likely to invalidate the contract if the activity is described as what? Essential public service. You can get essential, you can get public, or you can get 1, 2, and 3. You're really a long way to having the court say it will refuse to enforce the contract. Everybody see? Okay. Let's look at the conflict. You should have realized there was a slight conflict. Okay, so was the claim barred by express assumption of the risk in A, Jones, or B, Delury? So which one allowed Distal Horse to come in and bar the claim? Jones or Delury?
Jones.
You meant to be clicking. This is a pathetic attempt to bring your score up, but since you've already crashed and burned, I don't believe that we are able to preserve cookies. Oh, there's 27 of you now, though. Look at that, 29 people. Okay, so it's correct, right? Jones enforces the contract, whereas Delury, the court, refuses to enforce the contract. So we appear to have a conflict, right? Why is it the tension between the two cases seems so strong? Because both are what? They're both recreational activities, so we initially expect we get the same result, and we don't. So, at this point, we're simply arguing which one you agree with. Okay, so the next two questions are just what you think. There is no right answer. So, A to D, if you think about the result in Jones, the question is, plaintiff's claim in Jones, skydiving, should be barred. Do you strongly agree, agree, disagree, strongly disagree? There's no right answer, we're just getting percentages to see where you are. Okay, one person died, 29. Okay, let's see what we got. 9% of you strongly agree. 9 of 28. Oh, it's not giving me percentages, that's really annoying. I'll just have to do numbers. 9, 17. It should give me percentages. Oh, it's percentages is so small I can't read them. That's really annoying. Oh, it does 10%. Oh, there it is, 31%. Okay, so 59% of you disagree with the court's holding. Okay, let's do the next one. Same question. The plaintiff's claim in Delury should be barred. So do you strongly agree? Agree, disagree. What's that one? That's D, 10%. Okay. I have to add my percentages, 34%. And then that must be B, 48%. Okay, so you guys actually reach. About the same computer, really boring. Never mind. Okay, so a greater percentage of you think that plaintiff's claim should not be barred in Jones and think the claim should be barred in Delury. So anyone tell me why they reached a different result? Yes.
In the skiing accident, I think the plaintiff has more control over the situation than the plaintiff in the airplane accident because they don't physically have control over what's going on, whereas the skier can still possibly change the outcome.
Okay, so what factor would that be?
The last one.
So she says, I actually think this one changes and the plaintiff has more control over the accident. Anyone disagree? So let's stick with that factor. What's the court say? Does the court think the skier has control or not?
No,
yep.
The court said that the mountain had would have superior knowledge over how to maintain it. And there'd be a lot more people.
Okay, that's different, so don't change. Stick on this one, okay? So everybody see that on 4-4-4, right? The court seems to say about halfway down, right? Skiers are not in a position to discover and correct the risk of harm. They cannot assure against the area's negligence. They can't work out what a good layout looks like. So they disagree with you. What do people think? So who really has control of the risks right here? Do you think this is stronger or weaker than Jones? So Jones, we said half and half. What do you think? The court says we think the defendant has control. We have at least one person who's cogently disagreed. Yep.
I'm going to agree with her. In a plane, you should be able to reasonably expect that you will get to your destination safely, even if your destination is 5,000 feet in the air. On a skiing mountain, you know that there are going to be things in your way. There might be trees, not on the lowest level slopes, but if you're going on a higher level slopes, you know that there will be things you have to dodge, and dodging a metal pole isn't very far removed from the ability to dodge a tree. A skier should have the ability to
maneuver around. So notice one thing. Okay, we got more debate. Yep.
I kind of respectfully disagree with that. Now, I'm not going to say like an expert skier or anything, but there are certain impediments that you're not going to perceive going down a hill at 25 miles per hour when you're going straight down. And I mean, obviously you go mountain bike, but I would say there's impediments that you wouldn't see.
Besides people.
A metal pole, though, for a ski lift is huge.
Control the risks. Okay, so we got a question mark, but we're probably going towards a tick, okay? It certainly doesn't seem that different from Jones skydiving, right? But we get a different result. Yes? So what does it ask? If you look at the actual factor itself, what does it ask? Right. So is over that particular activity. So not all control over everything, right? When you get on the COTA bus, but who has control of the risks of carelessness? Right, and you'd say, okay, the bus company does, not the passenger.
Because I feel like in a ski situation, because we're going both ways, obviously it may seem as though both of them control
the risk. So we're maybe, so where you want to go half and half, just like skydiving, okay? So we're either saying, which is the court, there's more control, or we're willing to see maybe it's a half-half, which would make it the same as Jones. The problem is, though, we get a different result than Jones. Okay, so anyone wants to play a different factor and suggest that's the one that changes, or it's the same in Delorey versus Jones skydiving? Yep?
I just have a question. Is it a question of scope, like, for that controlling risk thing? Because, like, in the plane crash, you know, where we were saying the risk over thing, like, are we asking about whether the plane itself is safe? And then, you know, when it switches to the plane, it's activity. Like,
so it's what activity you focus on. It's not really that we're switching. It's when you run the test, what activity are you asking about? So here you can argue we have the same problem. What activity do you think we're asking about? I heard some people say skiing. So if you put skiing up here, I'm pretty much saying you're right. It's sort of half and half. The risk of skiing, half with the result, with the resort, half with the skiing.
You're talking about the layout.
He says, I want to call it layout negligence. That's what I want to call the negligence layout. If so, what are you going to say right here? It's complete control of the defendant. So it looks as if this factor is met. Everybody see that? See what you did? It's just like Jones, what activity do you think the defendant is providing? Skiing, it looks like half and half control. Layout of the ski center is completely different. Okay, let's do a different factor. Anyone want to do a different factor that they think comes out the same or different from Jones? Yeah, Mr. Cox?
I think the first one, since skydiving is not something a lot of people do, kind of seemed like they decided that was something that a handful of people decided to take a risk, whereas in skiing, they kind of overruled the Central Service by saying that it was something a lot of people do, so a public interest rises.
So a lot of people do it, right? They clearly say that. Where do you think that goes? So do you think it shows it's of great importance? Are you arguing that skiing is of great importance?
Or, I don't know, it kind of seemed like they just kind of made up their mind that because a lot of people do it, that they're just kind of maybe the essential service, even though it's not, that so many people
do it. Right. So what do they initially seem to say whether it's of great importance? What do they say? No, they say, okay, we don't think skiing is of great importance. But when they start discussing open to the public and this essential driven by adherence or opt-out, one of the things they say is thousands of people ski. So anyone think what they're doing with that?
They're basically saying that one of the largest tourism industries of Vermont is skiing and they want to make sure that they can still have them by next year.
No, because this kills the skiing industry, right?
Well, it protects the people going there to ski.
Correct, but like, the ski resorts aren't really happy. So you may think it's simply driven by economics, but it's hard to work out who has the biggest lobbying, the skiers, right? So where do they think the thousands of people go? Yep.
They bring up that they're invitees, so.
So hold that. Where do you think the thousands go? Yep.
They go to the ski resorts and buy tickets there, which confers a benefit onto the resorts.
Okay, but that's not one of these factors. I'm playing with these factors.
Would it be open to the public?
So one thing you could think the court's doing is they're really open. Right? There's thousands! And over here you have the six pathetic people, right? Okay, they're technically, but there's like six little people! Who's crazy enough, no, I mean awesome enough to do this, right? Whereas this one is really triple plus open. So you could say that on open to the public, Delury looks a lot stronger than Jones does. So it's a really common activity, it's really okay. Open to the public, yeah. So it looks, maybe they're slanting that factor, yep.
By that reasoning though, you could say just because someone does more business that it makes them more essential or makes them more open. And so what if you compare a small clinic that can only take, you know, 5 people in an hour, but you go to a giant hospital that takes hundreds of people on a daily basis, then you're saying that they're more open, so
so she says, I don't like the number of people as a criteria of open. They're both open to the public and they're both performing the same service, so you want them treated the same. You don't think it should weigh the other way. Good argument. How about essential? Do you think it's essential? So is it stronger or weaker than Jones? So if we're really asking essential, right, it looks about the same, right? Yeah, it's not really essential. On the other hand, what different factor have we got? That Mr. Fibner?
I was just going to say, I feel like essential shouldn't really be necessarily a factor because it's a black and white rule. It either is essential or is not essential. So it's hard to say that something is more essential or less essential. That's just how I think.
Right, but skiing versus, like, skydiving, neither of them feel like, the hospital. So both of them look like recreational. But there is one key fact that's different. So we got recreational for both of them. Right? So for both of them, we don't think they're looking really essential. What else have you got going on in the lorry?
That is the main income for
Vermont. There's something else on essential.
Take it or leave it.
There is no opt-out. Remember, this contract, unlike Jones, right? So Jones had the opt-out. There is no opt-out here. So there's an argument that it looks a little bit more essential. So you could argue that one of the key differences is right here, there's an opt-out, and right here, there's no opt-out. So that makes it look a little bit more take it or leave it. What do you guys think, though?
Yep. Isn't the opt-out and finding like a different contract altogether and not like whether or not the contract says so?
So he's like, okay, they could have gone elsewhere, right? Even though there was no opt-out on this contract, they could have gone elsewhere, so that doesn't seem such a big difference. What else? How about Jones? Do you think he really had the opt-out? Really? He's 17, he wants to skydive. You're telling me he read the opt-out provision?
But didn't he like specifically cross out a provision on there?
Does it say they crossed him out, or what did the evidence say?
Mom said it or something.
Says there's no evidence who crossed it out. There's no evidence who crossed it out. So notice, you could say that the key difference which controls the different result is this one, right? You can argue, look, they're both recreational, they're both open to the public, they both have mutual control, but this one had an opt-out provision. But that's working an awful lot onto the opt-out provision. See it? So I actually don't think that's what the court's doing. So,
why did she let her 17 months in
the idea that you have any control over any of your children just an illusion. Right now, it's basically bribery. Okay, Yes.
They bring up the general liability.
So what do they think changes? If you run it as laying out, what is defendant's service? Is it letting him speak? It's premises liability. So they think the issue is premises liability. Is that an issue of great importance? Do you think Distelbar should get to trump all of premises liability in Vermont? Answer? No. So notice, I think actually what changes is they run premises liability. They don't run skiing, they run premises liability, and then all of a sudden it's an essential service of great importance to the public. I will see you tomorrow. Please try not to ski or skydive before then. Tomorrow's reading is just plain hard, so, but it's not my fault. It's short but hard. That's why we're spending 2 days on